All right, I'll go ahead and call to order the regular board meeting of the Housing Authority of the City of Austin for Thursday, September 17, 1920, at approximately 12 o'clock, a little bit after, five after. We call the roll, please.
Sure, and Mr. Vice Chair, we're calling this will be the roll call for the Housing Authority of the City of Austin regular board meeting, Austin Affordable Housing Corporation's regular board meeting, and Austin Affordable Public Facility Corporation's board meeting. So this will be for all three. So, Vice Chair Bailey?
Here.
Commissioner Carrington?
Present.
Commissioner Duncan Hall?
Present.
Commissioner Apostolo?
Present.
And Chairman Ritchie? Mr. Vice Chair, we have a quorum, and we'll wait for our chair to return, and we can proceed on to the Housing Authority regular board meeting items. Now that a quorum's been certified, we can move to citizens' communication.
All right. We'll call citizens' communication. Do we have any people here to talk to us today?
Press star 6 to unmute.
Okay, looks like nobody here, and I'll turn the gavel over to the chairman.
All right, thank you, Commissioner Bailey. Next, we'll go to the consent agenda. On the agenda is the approval of the minutes from the July 16th, 2020 board meeting. Are there any amendments or changes that need to be made to those minutes? Yes.
Ira speaking. I have a comment to make on the minutes before they are approved, and it involves item number 7, the presentation regarding the Dominican group and the property on East St. Elmo Road. In the second paragraph of item 7, there is some interesting information. In other words, what I'm interested in is the 26 units are affordable to tenants earning 30% AMFI, 53 at 40%, 52 units at 50% of AMFI, and 32 at 80%. This is the first time I have seen this information available in this format, and I was wondering whether it would be possible to have the same type of information regarding the people, the percent of residents renting at each of these amounts. Is that possible to have that similar kind of information in our portfolio for others?
I'll defer to Mr. Gerber and his staff about the formatting.
Absolutely. We do try to provide you, Commissioner Duncan Hall, with that information in the briefings on each of the items that that you're presented with. We'll make sure that we do that more clearly, and we'll try to do it in that kind of an easy paragraph and put that right at the top of each of the items when they come forward in the future.
Yeah. The reason I'm curious about this is because, you know, we are saying that such property ranges between 30% and 8% of AMFI. And if we had it broken down in this manner, then it's easier for us as commissioners to say, well, such and such a percent is at max, but below that we have such a percentage of units being rented at such and such.
Absolutely, it's easy to do. And Ron, any issues there? We can just incorporate that into the documents in the future.
Thank you so much.
This is Ron Cowell. There are no issues to doing that. This particular property is a tax credit property with units that are basically restricted. So it's a little bit easier to give you exactly, because those units won't change. In other words, some of our portfolios, the percentage of who we serve changes monthly depending on how we're doing and leasing and all that. So I try and actually for this next group meeting in October, in your reports, you'll get an updated demographic report, which will highlight the percentages across the portfolio. But in this particular property, it is a tax credit property, so those units are restricted to those income levels. So it's easier to tell you exactly how many units of each level we're doing. But certainly, we can make it much easier, or we'll make it.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, before we go ahead, sir, and I think you need a vote on the board minutes.
I move approval of the board minutes for the July meeting.
Before we do that, let me just ask, does anybody else have any questions, comments related to this item? Hearing none, recognize Commissioner Duncan Hall for a motion to approve the minutes. I recognize Commissioner Apostolo for a second. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. And we'll go to item number two.
Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, we to accommodate a guest speaker, like to ask that we go to item seven, which is a statement of support for the ballot measure for Project Connect initial investment. Mayor Adler's policy chief, John Michael Cortez, is available and on the call, and if we could take that item up next, that would be appreciated.
Okay. If there are no objections from any of the board members, we'll go to item number seven, which is a presentation, discussion, and possible action regarding resolution number 2668, a statement of support for a ballot measure for Project Connect initial investment to address long-term community transit needs, including funding for affordable housing and anti-displacement strategies, along with the proposed transit corridors. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Cortez.
Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to be with you, and it's good to see many of your faces again. Some of you I haven't seen in quite a while. As Mr. Gerber mentioned, I'm John Michael Cortez, the special advisor to Austin Mayor Steve Adler. Mr. Gerber had informed me a while back that there was an item on the upcoming agenda to discuss and consider one of the items that's going to be on City of Austin voters' ballots this November, related to a tax rate election to fund the implementation of the Project Connect system plan, and thought it might be opportune for me to be with you and one, to address any questions that the board may have, any concerns, and give you a little bit of background information as to the item to inform your discussion today. So I imagine that this board is fairly well informed as to what the item entails. It would be an election to increase the City of Austin's maintenance and operations tax rate initially of about 8.75%, which translates to, despite some unfortunate misinformation that happens to be out there, it is not a 25% increase in property taxes. It amounts to something on the order of a little less than 4%. Estimated on the average tax bill. As this body knows, the City of Austin's tax rate only represents a relatively small portion of people's overall tax bill. When we write a check to Bruce Elfont to pay our property taxes, we don't write 10 checks for each taxing entity, we write one check. And on that one check property taxes, this would represent a little less than a 4% increase. With that, it would generate ongoing revenue to make an initial investment in the implementation of a citywide rapid transportation system known as Project Connect, which includes multiple new light rail lines serving various parts of our community, new rapid bus service, new park and rides and express bus service, neighborhood circulators. It would also include improvements to other transportation infrastructure along the corridors to accommodate the transit as well as sidewalk and other active transportation improvements in and around the stations, and electrifying Capital Metro's transit fleet to further reduce emissions. It's a very big investment package, and also I think of a unique interest to this body. It also includes something that I'm particularly very personally proud of. It includes $300 million over the course of this program to invest in community-driven strategies around affordability and anti-displacement strategies in and around the infrastructure that would be built as part of this program. I think it's an indication that we are learning from the mistakes of other communities who have made similar investments over the last few decades, and our own mistakes in the past, where we've made a transportation infrastructure investment in order to increase access to mobility and opportunity for people who need it in our community. But in doing so, we made the lands and the rents proximate to that access. There was the indirect impact of price escalation, rent escalation, and we saw displacement. In other communities, seeing displacement of vulnerable communities, the communities we intended to help with these investments. So I think the $300 million, which is, we've not been able to find another community working on this kind of transportation investment who has made this large of an investment in anti-displacement and affordability up front before seeing the impacts of these. So I'm really proud of this community for taking that action. The other thing I would mention that is also of unique interest to this body is going to that objective of trying to serve communities who really need including those residents who are served by this body and this organization. It is a system that will disproportionately serve vulnerable communities. It will disproportionately provide greater access to high-quality transportation to people. It will disproportionately provide access to lower-income and zero-car household communities, and also our city's existing stock and stock in development of income-restricted affordable housing, including those units that are part of the Housing Authority of City of Austin's portfolio. What we have recently seen from analysis by our neighborhood housing and community development, upwards of 60% of all of our existing within the city, including Haka properties, our existing portfolio of income-restricted housing is within about a half-mile walk of the proposed station area envisioned by the system plan. So I think it does a pretty good job of hitting, of aligning our housing investments with our transportation investments, which, you know, I'm personally excited to see. I can excruciatingly boring detail into anything that I've just mentioned, if you'd like, but I think I'll just leave it there and see if there's any questions or comments that you'd like me to try to answer or to take back to the mayor or anybody else.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just interject, we, in the survey that we did, 17 of 18 Haka properties will see an immediate impact because they're within a mile of either a train stop or an expanded bus route. Only Coronado appears to be a bit beyond that range, but even there, we think that they will see at least some more options to the nearest bus stops. And then we've counted at least 20 Austin Affordable Housing Corporation properties that would directly benefit from the Cap Metro plan with significant improvements, particularly up in the Tech Ridge area and then down towards Goodnight in southeast Austin. So that's encouraging. But we are concerned about the displacement issues, and we are concerned about how Cap Metro does this work. And I've had some conversations with Commissioner Apostolo and with some other residents. And so I wonder, and I don't want to put words in Commissioner Apostolo's mouth, but Commissioner, if you're comfortable maybe addressing it, one big question for John Michael would be about around that, you know, how exactly do you do this? And how do we make sure that historically underrepresented people, particularly the residents of Taka, are part of this discussion? I know this is the initial investment and there'll be more, but making sure that our folks that their voice is heard. So, Mary, did I describe that correctly, or I don't know if that's
absolutely a great question, Ms. Apostolou. Not to get too wonky, but oftentimes when the council or another body puts one of these propositions for either general obligation bonds or a tax rate election, something of this nature, on the ballot, there is also an accompanying contract with the voters, a resolution that's adopted by the body that forms a contract with the voters that says, essentially, should this proposition pass, here are things that the council commits to. And actually, again, getting a little wonky, it's one of the few ways that an existing city council can bind and tie the hands of a future city council. It's a covenant with the voters. And so it's a pretty as rock solid a promise as you can get from the city council as to the way things are going to be done. And within that contract with the voters, it does lay out how, among other things, anti-displacement investments will be administered. The way that we've laid it out is that we are going to immediately after the election, assuming that there's a successful passage of the proposition, is begin to work with each impacted community around the stations and around the corridors that are proposed here, and not prescribe to them how we think we ought to get these funds in order to maintain their affordability, but to work with them to co-create a unique neighborhood level strategy. For some communities, it's going to be acquiring land and partnering with the housing community for construction of new income-restricted units. For some communities, it's going to be looking at our existing affordable housing stock there. It could be perhaps maybe the term of the affordability is near ending. Maybe some of those funds ought to be used to leverage extension of affordability periods. For some communities, it's going to be support, either rental subsidies or tenant, enforcing tenant rights. For some people, it's going to be existing homeowners. It could be by providing them with legal support in order to clear up title, or it could be home repair. We don't want to presume that we know what the right strategy is for each that's impacted. We're immediately going to work with each community to develop those neighborhood level strategies. And the good news is we'll have $300 million plus funds that were already approved by voters in 2018 for affordable housing, for land acquisition, rental housing development assistance, and home repair. And so it's probably close to $500 million that we actually have to implement, along with other sources like our housing trust fund, et cetera, to actually implement these strategies at a neighborhood level. So the answer is, unfortunately, it depends what the community tells us as far as what the strategies are employed. But we have a rock solid promise, a legally binding promise by the city council that is the way that we will approach it, that we will engage the community meaningfully in determining how we address displacement and maintain affordability. And I put a link in the chat that takes folks to the city's website, and the contract with the voters that details this and other things out as to how these funds would be administered is available publicly there. I hope that answers your question somewhat.
That's great.
Good, Michael. This is Tyra. Did you say that you in fact have proposed routes, map of proposed routes available?
Yes, ma'am. It's available several different places, and the link that I posted in the chat in the city's website, I think it's available there. I can pull it up, pretty quickly and share it potentially. But is there a specific question?
Well, I just thought it would be interesting to be able to share information with our residents and supporters that we, in fact, are going to benefit from these proposed routes and have them indicate where our properties are and where the proposed routes would be.
Yes, and there we can provide materials to your staff, and those can be distributed at your properties. Yeah, we can definitely do that.
Thank you.
And that would include maps.
But
it's good to see you.
See you.
John Michael, if I could ask on behalf of the board, is there a way to ensure that our residents, you know, that we have resident ambassadors who are serving as mobility ambassadors, who are interacting actively with the city? Is there a, through the Smart City Ambassador Program, is there any, I know they're regularly engaging with Project Connect convenings, is there a way to kind of strengthen their role a little bit in making sure that the thousands of our residents are really heard as this plan rolls out? And Catherine Crego might want to ask a question related to it as well for the board.
Yes, absolutely. I think there is. One of the things I neglected to mention in answering the question is one of the other commitments made in the contract with the voters is the creation of a community advisory committee that will oversee from a community perspective the implementation of the strategies associated with this program, and they will be meeting once they're seated, they will be meeting in a public setting. They will be kind of the funnel for all the community inputs into how this is implemented over time. And I think that would be a great place for the mobility ambassadors to get engaged. And I should say the system plan that is proposed to be developed is really just the next step in the development and evolution of this program. Nothing is yet set in stone. What we're essentially saying is the community commits to invest in this system, but before this moves forward, because we're anticipating a significant investment by the Federal Transit Administration for the capital costs for the system, we have to couple of years of continued work through the environmental assessment process, the National Environmental Policy Act, and that will involve the community up and down each one of these corridors to make sure that as we implement this, we're not having any disparate impacts or disproportionately burdening any vulnerable communities. And that is also an opportunity for people to have influence on some of the detailed decisions associated with these projects. Where a station is specifically located, what it looks like, ensuring that there's safe pedestrian access, all of those things, making sure there are safe crossings of the corridor. So those are the kind of detail level on the ground public input opportunities into the design that will, those decisions aren't made. Those discussions will happen over the next 2 to 3 years after November. And that's also in addition to the Community Advisory Committee for the overall input. Is a great opportunity for the ambassadors to be engaged.
Could Commissioner Apostolo and Catherine Crego work directly with you and your folks to I think about Commissioner Apostolo, I think about Lupe Garcia, who's one of the leading residents at Santa Rita, and there are others who have been mobility ambassadors that we've worked with, like Kimberlyn Barton Reyes and others. Is there a way that we can follow up separate from this and just make sure they're included?
Absolutely.
That'd be great. Commissioners, are there any other questions of John Michael? If there aren't, I would just highlight that the resolution statement at the end says, be it resolved, now therefore be it resolved, the HACA Board of Commissioners recognizes the extensive public process conducted by Project Connect staff and supports the conclusions of the process that increase affordability, fight displacement, and create access to opportunity for Austin's most vulnerable residents. Be it further resolved, the HACA Board of Commissioners firmly supports a ballot measure for the initial Project Connect investment. And I highlight those two because obviously it's what you're resolving the agency to do. But I think it's important to note that HACA's interest was squared around the ideas of increasing affordability, fighting displacement, and now with John Michael being here, you know, make sure that we're able to engage as this rolls out. And again, this is an initial investment. There'll be other ballot measures on improved transit in Austin, and I think there'll be a great opportunity for us to be part of that work. And we hear consistently from our residents the five great things. You know, it's you know that complement housing, you know, and it's job training, education, health and wellness, digital inclusion, and transit. And so this is a big program. It's not a perfect program, but it's a strong program that could really benefit from our active engagement and support here at this point. So the staff is recommending the passage of this resolution, Mr. Chairman.
With that, does anyone have any questions or further comments they want to make?
I've got one quick question for John Michael. Who are you going to have opposing this? The usual suspects?
Largely the same groups who oppose every initiative of this type are likely to be in opposition of this item in November.
And you said you thought there would be some federal grant money that will be coming down in a couple of years to help.
Absolutely, Commissioner. We have a high degree that these projects will be very competitive for Federal Transit Administration New START grants or capital investment grants, I think is they're called now. There's grants that are being awarded every year to communities like Austin, committed at the local level to these investments. In putting together the cost for the program, we conservatively estimated that the federal government would cover about 40% of the capital costs. What we're seeing the federal government do very recently, as of this year, they're investing upwards of 45%. In these types of programs throughout the country. So they may be even stepping up in a bigger way than we anticipated. And of course, we also, nothing's for certain, but we presume that at some point, probably next year, there's likely to be an infrastructure stimulus opportunity that many of these programs would be teed up for as we move forward.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move approval of resolution number 02668 in support of this project.
There's been a motion made by Commissioner Duncan Hall. Is there a second? Seconded by Commissioner Apostolo. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Cortez.
Thank you all for your great work.
All right, well, we'll proceed to item number two, which is a update on HACA's actions related to the coronavirus, an update on HACA's residents and client support system.
Pilar and Catherine and Leilani, I'll turn it over to y'all. And Barbara.
Thank you. I think Pilar wanted me to move ahead with this. Can you all hear me?
Sure can.
Okay. Our HACA Resident Support Center, the call center, numbers for August, July and August, we had about 650 calls. Calls for the survey completion, which Catherine will talk more about in technology, about 380. We did about 1,000 calls and texts related to the school supply distribution that happened this month. And that was really helpful because when we were doing our school supply distribution was the three rainiest days of the year. And we had to do some moving around and last minute changes. And so the residents were calling into the call center to find out where the supplies were getting distributed and when, and we were responding back with texts and giving information to people. So that was really helpful. As you'll see in your report, about 40% of the calls that came in were from families, about 36% from seniors, 12% were from our Housing Choice Voucher residents, and about 12% for non-residents. And most of those non-residents are calling about how they get into housing or how they check their waitlist status to get into housing. I think overall the message that we keep getting from our callers is they're really happy that somebody's answering the phone. And they don't always get that in other departments, but they know at the call center somebody will answer and we can help them resolve their questions or get them directed in the right place. We had a pretty good success story with a resident that called and mentioned that her AC was out, a public housing or a PBRA resident, but she had COVID-19 and couldn't get the response from the maintenance because of that, an immediate response, and we were able to get her connected right away with Family Elder Care, and their service coordinator got her a fan and got her connected to all other support, a bunch of other support services to address her positive COVID test. So that's just one example of the kinds of things that are happening in our call center. Is there any questions?
Do you want me to take it from here, Barbara, about the rest of the coronavirus slide?
Sure.
Okay. So good afternoon. Good morning. Good afternoon, HACA Board of Commissioners, fellow colleagues, and guests. So I will be speaking about the first resolution, which you all approved for the $250,000. So I have some good news to report about where that money has been devoted to. First of all, we did open Booker T. Washington, the community room, as part of that $250,000 budget. $83,900 of it was to open the Booker T. Washington community room hosted by the Boys and Girls Club. They're open from Monday through Friday, 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. during this remote session with AISD. As y'all were aware, school remotely started on September 8th. So a lot of our kiddos have been attending the club. They've done some marketing. And once the schools have opened and the remote sessions have ended, the Boys and Girls Club will continue to provide after-school programs from 3 to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday, and they will also be servicing during spring break 7:30 to 5:30 p.m. to make sure that we have youth services available at Booker T. Washington. The priority will be for the working parents, of course, because we want to make sure that we identify that the children are not left at home while mom and dad are out working and they have the support that they need. We are looking at the space, which was assessed, that we looked at as far as measurements for the community room for Booker T. Washington. We could adjust the furniture to accommodate 20 to 25 youth, I hate to say safely, but with CDC guidelines and protocols. And so 20 is going to be the maximum amount of students that can be served at Booker T. Washington at this time. The student to teacher ratio will be 1 to 10. So that is what the $83,900 out of the 250 is being devoted to. In addition, as you all know, there are protocols for that. The desks are 6 feet apart. They're taking temperature checks 3 times a day. If any of the children spike above 99.5 degrees Fahrenheit, they're going to contact the parents. There's an area where they can seclude the children. So we're really trying to follow as many CDC, TEA, and Austin Public Health guidelines to make this successful. And also there is going to be deep cleaning. The staff will be cleaning 3 times a day, and they'll be deep cleaning nightly from contracted staff who have what they call Ghostbuster backpacks that will actually spray the entire community room. So we're trying our best. And so that's part of the contract. And also face masks will be used at all times. Granted, I only spoke about Booker T. Washington, but let's also remember that the Boys and Girls Club is also open at Meadowbrook, servicing about 20 students, and also Chalmers South, which is about 20 students as well. And also communities and schools will start to open as well as Booker T. Washington, Bolden, Meadowbrook, and Santa Rita. And that's to provide the mental health social services for our at-risk students. So 83,900, that's part of the budget. Also $144,000 was budgeted for the paraeducator program. And that's where we have our residents who have the paraeducator certification to assist with a HACA at-home learning program. And more details can be provided from Barbara about the paraeducator. And we want to make sure that our residents and our parents are engaged in this, the success of the coronavirus slide. About $9,000 was devoted to HVAC system. I see Jimmy Teasel is here. He made sure that the HVAC for the community rooms are improved to ensure the safety of the staff and the children and the partners who will be at these community rooms are being used and being opened exclusively for youth programs. And in addition, $15,000 was used to purchase headphones. For the first time, we have included headphones for the kids as part of the back to school supply distribution. So that was a really nice item to have, so that our children can work remotely with those headphones. So that's a quick overview of where the $250,000 went. It is all spent. I guess I can say that every dollar has been spoken for. And just so you all are aware about, thank you all for having the faith of executing this HACA at home. It is a labor of love. I will say that it took us a while to get it done, but we're not completely done yet. We're still in the midst of it. But just so y'all know that it was money well spent, and we'll be providing more reports regarding the numbers and any other follow up from partners. So this is our first time doing it, but I feel that you will be pleased with the results. So with that, do I hand it over to Barbara Beck for paraeducator or Pilar? Or any questions for me?
Lalani, I have a question. This is Edwina. Did the $250,000 pretty much cover the priorities that you all wanted to address?
For now, yes. Catherine Prager will speak separately about the digital inclusion piece. So there's a device piece. So that's very important as well. But this was really to open our community room that we mm-hmm. had proposed to make sure that there were safe spaces. So for a quick answer, yes. Can we ask for more money? Sure. Then we can extend it to other programs. I mean, if you're offering, absolutely. But yes, for now, for the pilot program, I believe that it was adequate.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll just add on the paraeducator program, our progress. We have about 20 people, 20 residents that are interested. Six of them have already received the training, and they'll be able to receive just a short 10-hour training from ACC on all of the learning platforms and the technology, and then they'll be ready to get to work supporting families. And then the other 14 will be in the pool to receive the full paraeducator certification course from ACC, so that we can, after that, get them started as paraeducators supporting families. And just to let you know a little bit of how it's all going to work together is that the survey that Catherine's been doing with families to identify the technology needs, they've identified about 70 families that need more support. So working with our resident support staff and the paraeducators, they'll be able to figure out who needs what level of support, and then we'll provide that additional support to those families as long as they're, you know, open to receiving that, and be able to triage the most those most in jeopardy. For example, they identified a family that said, at Bolden, that said, our kids didn't go to school, they don't have computers. And we got the call that that was going on, and I was able to connect with CIS. CIS had been working with the families. I guess the computers had been lost or broken for three of the kids. And so CIS was already working with the school to try to get the school to provide those directly, because the AISD technology line is really backed up. So working together, we're triaging and addressing the learning needs. There was also some mental health issues in that family, and CIS has the wraparound services to provide that support so that the kids can get in school and get learning.
Catherine, do you want to go ahead and take over next?
Sure. And Flora, it looked like you were speaking, you were muted.
Oh, I was just saying that that was our report on coronavirus activities, but the next item, item number two, are you ready for us to speak about that, Mr. Harper?
Sure. Why don't we go ahead and proceed? Are there any more questions related to the coronavirus item? And obviously, we also provide a report on other things that the agency is doing, sort of a top five in each division of how we're managing the coronavirus. And so we commend that to you to review at your leisure. But obviously, the work that Barbara and Leilani are doing has been, you know, the most critical. Getting kids back to school has been the greatest challenge and frankly, one of the greatest joys of this thing. It's been exciting to see kids wanting to get back to school and learning and frustrated that they can't. And so the work that they've done and now also with Catherine's help and support has been key. So, Catherine, why don't we employ anything you want to close out on this, and then we can switch over to number three unless there's board comment.
I just wanted to introduce board item number three, which is resolution 2666, which is an amendment to our budget. But please note that this is to ratify action that you took at the board meeting in July. This is to add the $300,000 that you all committed to digital inclusion to help our families be successful with at-home learning and with technology. And Catherine Crago is going to present, but she's been super busy with this. She's been working with her team of 14 ACC interns, with resident ambassadors, smart city ambassadors, with AISD, computer and internet deployment team, AISD parent support specialist manager. She's been working with Capital Metro and several internet service providers. And so I'll let Catherine present the resolution and give you a little bit of that information. Catherine.
Good afternoon, commissioners. When we last met in July, we shared with you that we have about 650 families who have K through 12 students, about 1,400 K through 12 students. Due to move outs and various things, we're working with basically right now about 612 K through 12 households. In the last couple of months, we have completed surveys, detailed in-depth surveys with 370 of those households, representing about 900 kids. And we are always looking for those three legs of the stool, right? You asked us to make sure that each child in the home has a device that they could go back to school with. You asked us to make sure that if they were not living at a Google Fiber property, that they had access to an affordable broadband connection, and also that they had access to digital literacy resources and training. And so over the last 8 weeks or so, we have reached those families. Initially, we found that of those families that we had surveyed, the 370%, 24% of those families were good to go. They had, each child in the home had a device, they had a free or very low cost internet connection, and they felt confident that they could help their family with internet and computers at home, or they had a resource to learn how to do that. That means that 76% of those families told us, no, each of the children in my home does not have a computer. No, I have internet now, but I'm paying $100 a month and I can only afford to do that for a couple of months. Or I didn't know what was going on. Nobody's contacted me. How do I get my family connected? We were able to provide direct assistance to those families, to those 280 families that needed resources. After providing direct assistance to those families, we started to follow up with them. We've done two or three touch points with each one of those families to close that gap, to make sure that they were able to get the help that they needed. To get those devices from AISD, and particularly to make sure that the charter schools who had committed to providing those devices to families had actually committed those devices. We've been able to do that in part through our back-to-school task force, And, you know, that connectivity and building relationships with those folks, and also through our partnerships with AISD. As we go forward, you might hear in there that there's 220 families that we have not reached. We haven't reached. So how do we know how they're doing? We know how they're doing because we have a data sharing agreement with AISD. We can see if they have requested devices or not from AISD, in part. We might have information from other residents, where those residents are, they may be neighbors or they may be related in some way. And we believe that of those 220 that we haven't reached, about 70 of those are probably, you know, in the at-risk category somewhere. So what we are doing now is we are going to hire a contractor, someone that can knock doors for us, to go back to those families and make sure that we have their most current contact information. I'll just stop there and ask if there are any general questions, and then I'll fill you in on the other two legs of the stool, the internet access and the digital literacy. Yes, Pilar.
Hold on for a second, because I've got several questions.
Oh.
Let me just get them in right now.
All right.
Doctor, when you say they're high risk, can you go into more detail about what that means?
So we, the survey that we conducted, we used questions from the U.S. Census Pulse Point that was taken in May and the Pew Center for Internet and Society. And basically there's three questions that we're asking them that would put them in a risk category. And here's how they're weighted. We asked the parents, do you yourself have a computer that you can use, to learn how to use, the tools that your children are using for school? If the parent said rarely or never, we said, okay, that's 20% of the risk factor. Then we asked them, have you ever had an internet connection? If they said no, then we said, okay, that's a risk factor. They haven't ever been online from home. But 50% of the weighting was based on this one question. And the question is, how much do you agree? I know enough about internet and computers to help my children with their schoolwork. If they disagreed or definitely disagreed with that statement, we put them in a risk category. So that was one of the deciding factors. And, of course, we're making our own risk assessments. There are people who strongly agree that they can help their kids with computer and internet. But in conversation, we learn that maybe they don't know what tools their children use, or they don't know how to recover a password. So we're also marking those as well, even though the parent expressed confidence that that they had everything that they needed to succeed. Other questions?
Catherine,
Let me just follow up on that. So of the 200, is that part of, or is it in addition to the 650 that you've identified?
Part of.
Okay.
That is part
so
of.
The 650 really were able to reach and touch and help 400. And so we got another 200. We're trying to figure out how do we touch them, how do we help them.
Correct. And the 200, we're using data not directly from them, like from AISD. We haven't started sharing with charter schools yet. We're using data from communities and schools and our partners. We know that about 30 of those 200 are on AB Honor Roll and Perfect Attendance. So we think maybe we're not hearing back from them because they're good now. They don't need our help. But based on the 400, the approximately 400 that we reached, we're thinking probably still out of that 220, probably 60 to 70 families may just need significant help. And so we need to go out and door knock to make sure they're getting that help. I just want to add, we are working closely with AISD, with the Parent Support Specialist Coordinator, Leonor Vargas, who's been tremendous. And so we are also triangulating with them because in some cases the teachers are going out themselves and knocking doors when they can't get a hold of a student. So this is just, it's, you know, it takes a village, and, you know, we've all got lots of spreadsheets, and we are using our partners as much as we can. because especially when, you know, it's kind of in their governance domain and to save our resources, but also in terms of accountability, we want the family to be connected with that, that parent support specialist. So if they want to go knock a door, we're happy to let them do that.
The other question I have is of the 70, are they dispersed or they're, or are they concentrated into several properties?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So remember when we last met, we said we basically have 14 family properties. Seven are really Google Fiber properties and have been for several years, and seven are not. It's the actually in the seven that are not where we found the lowest rate of connectivity between the family and the school. And those seven that are not are in August, we saw that 22% of the families without internet had registered for a Wi-Fi hotspot, while about 46% of Google Fiber property families had registered online for a computer and for internet, according to AISD. So, and those families are traveling, they're not doubling up on internet, but they may need a Wi-Fi hotspot. So it's basically in those properties that are have less digital capacity where we're probably seeing the greatest need.
All right. Pilar, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to get these questions in real quick.
Yeah, we just wanted to mention that of those 220 families that we have not been able to reach, the information that we do have on 63 of them is that they're on the AB honor roll. So even though we haven't spoken to them, we're going to assume that they're okay, that they're probably not going to be in that high risk category. But we're still going to use a contractor to go knock on doors, provide information, and let them know that we can help them obtain what they need. That's all I wanted to mention. And I can wrap it up if you like. There are no other questions?
And question four.
I think we got other questions coming. Commissioner Beckenhall, I see you, and Commissioner Carrington, I see you. So Commissioner Beckin, I'll go for it. Go. Please
okay,
proceed.
Thank you. One question I have regarding, not regarding the education itself, but regarding the census taking. Are you guys involved directly in assisting with census taking? If not, do we know the status of where our properties are in terms of responding to the census?
So we're not involved directly as enumerators. We're not allowed to go and help a family fill out the census. But we are involved in that we received two different grants, one from the United Way and one from the Hogg Foundation, to target specific properties that are in their hard-to-reach zip codes. And we use those grant funds to hire or provide stipends to residents who served as count coaches, and they tried to penetrate their community at their properties and the surrounding community around the property to encourage people to complete the census and provide them information as to where they can go for more information, and go to 211 can help them. So we did participate heavily in that. We don't have the percentage of reporting for our sites because we can't seem to find somebody at the census that can give us that information per site. They're starting to release information by zip code, but we're having a hard time getting further deeper.
I'm just concerned with the deadline fast approaching that we at least have the information from our residents that will assist us in hopefully in getting more grants and money, et cetera.
Yes, we've tried so very many different things to help with that.
Yeah, Murphy Rowland of our staff has done yeoman's work in this area, and he's a former military guy, and he's brought a military precision to trying to mobilize folks at the properties, and it's been a major topic at each of our resident council meetings and our citywide advisory board calls. Captain Craig just posted something in the chat that said that the city manager said yesterday that the city is at 65%, meaning that we could potentially lose up to $330 million due to undercount. So it's a significant challenge that we want to make sure that HACA's doing its part on. But we've been mobilized, but it's tough in the best of years, and this year especially so.
We, just to clarify, we have a lot of plans to do big events and do on-site registration, and we had to switch all that at the last minute and figure out how to get not only the message out, but first train our residents to be able to use the digital tools to get the message out. So it's been a big switch, but we did have 22 residents that were actively involved in that outreach. And they knocked on 2,000 doors before the coronavirus, and they probably sent out a million messages after the coronavirus.
So let me just make sure I understand this.
A related question. What about voter registration?
Leilani, you want to share a little bit about that?
Yes, we have partnered with Lloyd Doggett's office as well as ADAPT, which deals with the campaign for the elderly and disabled. And so we do have some flyers, some of them were inserted to some of the handouts that we've done for the PPE distribution with a face mask. It's also being, same thing, Murphy Rollman is attending all the resident council officers, and we also had a huge educational campaign to push out the voting. Actually, it's the other way around because the residents were getting a little bit upset that they were getting a lot of phone calls and text messages about who you're going to vote for. So the message is out there, and they know that the deadline is October 5th to register. They know that the date is November 3rd, but we're encouraging them to apply by mail, to vote by mail, and to vote early. So, yes, there's also just incongruent with the census. We're also basically speaking about the voter registration and the voting on the during the same topic. It goes hand in hand.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry, do you have additional questions?
No, I think it will.
Mr. Chair, okay. I had a question.
I know. I know it's a little different, but a little difficult, but I was trying to make sure Pirate asked her a question. I'm coming to you next, and I'll ask my questions last.
All right.
Go ahead, you have the floor.
Mine is an easy one, and I don't know if it's Catherine or Pilar. Of the 220 families that we haven't heard from, or they haven't reached, understanding that 63 of those are on the AB honor rolls, what's the breakdown between students that are in AISD and in charter schools?
Oh, I haven't looked at that number specifically or pulled it, but I would say it's about the same as in our general population. It's about 30% charter and 70% AISD.
Okay.
So it's interesting. There are a few small charter schools that did a really good job of getting out in front, but we have maybe 10 to 12 families in those schools that were all set to go when we first surveyed them. But everyone else seems to kind of be on the same trajectory of just getting those families that are difficult to reach last. But I will find out, Commissioner Carrington, at, you know, for the post report in October and break that out, some insight between the charter and AISD schools, if you would like.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Mr. Apostola, do you have a question? Commissioner Bailey? Let me ask this, because I actually know someone who's actually working for the census and actually somebody who goes door to door every day. And as I understand from them, when they go to an apartment complex, if they can't find someone, they can actually go to the apartment manager, and to the extent they're willing to cooperate, they can provide the data on the family or the individual who lives in a specific unit. So my question is, I know we're, you know, their residents are receiving all this information, but are our property managers working with the census folks when they come to them?
I don't know if Sophia has heard of any of that happening.
Yes. Actually, the Chairman Ritchie, that was a topic that was brought up at our last staff meeting. And because we did have a manager that shared that a census a badge wearing individual came to the office requesting information. And so I did share with the staff that yes, we can provide the information in terms of number of household members within a given unit. Now, the only caveat is if there are other individuals who are residing in that unit that are not necessarily on the lease, we won't know about it and they will not be counted. So that's the only shortcoming, if you will, that if we are not aware of other occupants in the unit, we won't be able to pass that information unless, you know, the actual head of household is interviewed.
Okay. The reason why I asked that, because I have several friends who are working part-time for the census, and they work up to 26 to 30 hours a week, depending on what they want. And they have shared with me that they actually, when they go to a house, let's say they go to a house and someone's not there and the neighbor's there, they're able to ask the neighbor, and the neighbor's able to provide them information. Yes, there's a husband and wife that live there. This is what their race is. Yes, they do have kids. Here's what their age of the kids are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in order for them to get the information they need. Now, obviously, there's more detailed information before the census taker. If they can get that basic information, then it allows them to, get most of what they need. And to the extent they need additional information, it allows them to go back a second time and get that missing piece of information at another point in time, or have someone else, one of their colleagues, follow up. So I just want to make sure that we are, our property managers are assisting where they can. Obviously, as you related in that particular instance, if there are other family members that are living there that we don't know of, then obviously, you know, there's nothing we can do. But to the extent that we can be helpful providing them the basic information, my hope is that we are going to do that.
Yes, we are, Chairman Ritchie.
All right. So are there any other questions that people have related to item number 3? I just want to say overall, I think you all are doing a great job, both in terms of identifying families who need assistance, both for the digital process, as well as just making sure we're reaching out to folks to identify what are the needs they may have. I really appreciate the effort that you all are making. I know this is different from what we normally do in our line of work, but this pandemic has required us to be nimble and to reinvent ourselves to address the needs of our residents. So I just want to say thanks. I had no doubt that you all would spend the money appropriately and do so in a very impactful way where we would reach folks. Every day, there's some story in the news, whether it's print or broadcast media, about kids or this generation of kids who are going through COVID, how they are going to be left behind because of their inability to progress academically. And they talk about the fact that their ability to earn money later in life is going to be severely impacted, which means their ability to pay taxes and be productive and to be able to make a difference. So I appreciate and applaud you all for all that you all are doing. Keep up the good work. If you need additional resources, please let us know so we can look at and see what we can provide. Obviously, the board cannot commit, but we are certainly open to working with you to provide you the necessary resources and tools to do your job, working with both the parents as well as with the children.
Thank you, Commissioners and Chairman Ritchie. So at this time, the staff is asking the board to approve Resolution 2666, which is an amendment to the HACA annual budget. of $300,000, and it is an action that you approved back in July that you're ratifying, and you will hear about it again next month when Ann Gass presents the overall budget amendment for the agency.
Let me just ask one question, because the governor just had a press conference, and that's kind of what I was doing. I had to pay attention to that. He just announced that with certain industries, they're going to be able to go to 75% capacity, specifically restaurants, libraries, museums, fitness centers, all retail establishments, bars will always, obviously, they won't be able to increase capacity. But I would ask you all to think about how does that impact us and our residents, given that libraries can now open up and whether some of our kids are utilizing the libraries. And then how does, you know, what impact will this have on us as a business?
Yeah. And Commissioner Commissioner Ritchie, I think, you know, we're certainly considering those various scenarios where capacity rises or falls. I know that we may be expecting, according to public health service, a spike in November. And so we are playing with these kind of dials. There's two sides to it, what the school is allowing. And the other side is, can the parent say, I don't want my child to go to school? And we're finding just anecdotally, this was not a survey question from us, but I would say over half the parents are concerned about their kids going because they have some kind of underlying condition. And there's a good chunk that are passionate about their kids going back. We are partnering with the library and the Parks Department to explore the idea of embedded libraries at Haka community centers and other things that may support that capacity changes. So just a little detail there.
All right. And then let me just say this obviously nobody has a crystal ball. No one knows everything. But I'm, you know, happen to be in contact with different folks who are in the medical field. And what they've shared with me is that the biggest sort of drivers right now are individual gatherings where somebody has a birthday party or a wedding or something like that. It's individuals. And then also the other big driver is just the construction industry. You've got a lot because it's considered essential while people are wearing masks. But, you know, there's only so far you can stand away in order to read the blueprint, you know. And if certain tasks that require you to be next to somebody when you're pouring concrete and things of that nature. But what they've said is that probably between now and the end of 2021, that we're just going to see a series of different spikes. Most of them will occur around holidays. In fact, I was meeting with the medical director for the city of Houston last week. They're trying to figure out what's, you know, waiting for the numbers to come out from Labor Day. But they really think there's going to be a huge spike around Thanksgiving, Christmas, and in the New Year, because those are traditional holidays. Because as the numbers are going down right now, people get lax and feel like they don't have to follow because COVID is either passing or their resistance is good. But I think, you know, you all are right in terms of looking at around the holidays, in terms of what's going to happen. And we've got two big ones coming up with Thanksgiving and with Christmas. And so from an operations standpoint, you know, I'm glad that we're, you know, still kind of operating remotely. But I think, you know, you guys are doing a great job in terms of being diligent in terms of trying to have workarounds for our families and our residents because we're just going to see spikes until there's a vaccine. And most of the medical folks are saying we're going to be in this new normal until the end of 2021. So for what that's worth, I appreciate it. Mike, you've been trying to get the floor, so go for it.
Oh, no, we agree with you, and we're trying to exercise great caution. You know, right now we have 11 residents who have active cases that we're aware of. We've lost two residents. Two residents have died of COVID-19, and I'm sure there are others that we don't know about, but we do know of those two. We're trying to, again, continue to stay. We're always open, but we are going to work smart, and we are following the guidance of the CDC and frankly, our own city's approach to, you know, working with Dr. Escott, the medical authority for the city, and others here to try to make what we think are appropriate decisions. It's scary that, you know, we hear from, you know, I've heard from residents, and I've heard from staff talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, really nothing's improved. Yeah, and the fact that the CDC put out a number the other day that said that, you know, right now we're at 196,000 people who've died because of COVID, and roughly 35 to 40,000 people a day are estimated to, you know, new known cases. But the fact is that by January 1st, they're suggesting that there may be as many as 400,000 deaths. They're projecting 400,000 deaths. I mean, that's an extraordinary number of people. And our goal, and the thing we keep talking about over and over, is we don't want any of those to be people that we know, and we want to protect our residents and our Haka family. And so we are working, and I was going to highlight it at the end, but we are working as part of this to try to figure out a way to get our front office open. So you'll notice if you come by the office, you'll see some construction going on where we're enclosing the front desk, and we will be working on a solution so that people who need to see a team member and drop off forms and paperwork and work through things can come in and have somebody that's working again in a safe space. But until they're served, they'll be waiting in a car, or they'll be waiting, needing to wait outside. We'll have very limited wait space, but we're reworking our space to try to accommodate folks as best we can, knowing that some folks again need that one-on-one contact. But it's certainly been challenging, and I just can't say enough to you, commissioners, about how fortunate we are as an agency to have Leilani and Barbara and Catherine and Pilar. I mean, you want to talk about 6 months of holding things together, you know, with duct tape and glue. I mean, it's really been a challenge. And so I say thanks again to all four of you and to your teams. Great leadership. And with that, Mr. Chairman, you will see these again on the next budget. When it comes to you all as part of the larger budget amendment, and we would ask for a motion to approve resolution 2666.
And before I entertain that motion, I just got one question. I'm looking for one, but I don't see him. Ken Bolden.
He's not on the call.
Okay. What I would recommend is that you have Ken, as we're going through this process, record it. Written and put it up so that you can put it up, because what we're doing is more than what I think what I'm hearing from our colleagues in the industry. So that I know you all asked, when can we get an award of excellence or award of merit? I think this is one of them, because we're going to extraordinary lengths to protect our residents, and also to make sure our kids are getting the education as well as our residents. The adults have access to technology, so they can themselves look for jobs and stuff like that to the extent that jobs are available. But I think you want to record this, document this, so that you can present this later on. So it's not something we come to at the end of and we think about, well, what should we be? What should we tout ourselves with? So I would say that. So with that, I will recognize Commissioner Carrington for a motion to approve resolution number 2666, and I'll recognize Commissioner Duncan Hall for a second.
So moved.
Sorry, you got to get off of mute.
Second.
With that, is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. The next, we'll go to Mr.
Mr. Chairman, before we go to Ron, if we could go to item number 6. Jimmy's got a short item. It's a resolution number 2665, approving the purchase of an energy recovery unit and related engineering services for here at the central office. Jimmy, if you could go and cover that item in about 30 seconds. The rest of the agenda is really the development items, and we'll let Jimmy get back to the pool.
Relax. Well, good afternoon, commissioners, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you. It's good to see everybody. 2665.
Can you tell us one thing real quick?
I was disappointed that you didn't actually have a rendition of what a energy this device, this energy recovery unit, so we can see what it looks like.
Well, I bring one in for you, but it's about 8 feet by 8 feet by 10 feet tall, and it's a giant cabinet that sits on the rooftop, and it provides for fresh air to be pulled in from the outside air and flushed into the building, and it has been broken down and non-working for some time, and it's been one of our projects that we've been trying to do for the past few years. We had to figure out how to do it, and it just happened to occur during COVID time. And it ends up being a critical component of indoor air quality, which is what we really need to focus on during this time as well. So this provided an opportunity to pull this piece of equipment out, figure out how to get it done, pull it out, and replace it. And basically, it's a large cabinet on the roof that pulls in outside fresh air and flushes it into the building and helps to provide for healthy air exchange in the building. And so the entire 2665 resolution is for the contract to pull this out and replace it with a new one that has to be custom made for the building for its size. Please.
Comment. Jimmy, I just want to thank you for your explanation of this entire process. I do think I understand the value of it. And, of course, I think it's something we all want in our homes and our offices, et cetera, and on every airplane that flies. So thank you for helping me understand.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I think the explanation does it all. But I did want to mention that I just got a note from our contractors yesterday that the United States Air Force is actually, looking at the same kind of equipment that we've been installing on the rooftop and other air conditioning systems and in some of our remote sites already. I think we're on a good track for with good equipment and the right answer for improving indoor air quality as best we can in our facilities. And this is just part of that equation. And so without further ado, we're just requesting approval of the contract in an amount of $151,000.
All right. So, Jimmy, when you said the Air Force, I thought you were going to say they wanted to put a helipad on top of our building.
Well, I'm working on that. If we can make money
on it, a helipad on top of our building. We don't have that type of – we don't have those employees. They have that luxury to have their own helicopter. If they do, they are a dollar-a-year employee.
Believe it or not, when COTA was going on, when the Formula One race was going on, there was some proposal to go and helicopter folks from COTA out to our parking lot here for folks who were staying at the fancy hotels downtown. Never happened, but there was that idea was floated at one point. Not on the building, but in the parking lot here.
If we get charged for it, Mike, it's considered.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're not.
Unrelated business income.
Yeah, we run a nonprofit, but we're not running a nonprofit on that.
Well, so thanks for the jokes. If there aren't any other questions, I would like to ask for approval of the contract in an amount of $151,000. It's been good to see you all today.
I want to entertain a motion to approve resolution number 2665, approval and purchase of an energy recovery unit and related engineering services for the installation at HACA's central office. Commissioner Duncan Hall has a motion. I mean, makes the motion. I recognize Commissioner Apostello for a second. And then is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks, Jimmy. All Mr. Right, Chairman, I'd like to ask if we could go to under reports, you receive a president's report, and you will in the future receive a chief financial officer's report as well. I think, as you know, we've had a transition in our finance department. Martha Ross has gone on to pursue other opportunities and professional work, and I just wanted to say two quick things. One is that Martha did some extraordinary things here during her time in leadership. and we are going to miss her. And we wish her the best and much success. And the work that she came in 3 years ago to do with RAD and taking over from Thomas and really transitioning systems was very difficult. And she worked very, very hard on those systems, and we're grateful for her work and her professionalism, and I just want to acknowledge that. Ann Gass has been asked to take over as acting chief financial officer, with big shoes to fill. And we're going to make it a standard of this meeting to give you all just kind of a quick overview of finance. And we're going to do that today. It's going to be very, very short, but over time it'll grow longer. And of course, the budget and audit committee will go even in more depth when we do those committee meetings as well. So, Ann, if you would go ahead and give your report very quickly and under the reports item. Go ahead.
Happy to do so. Good afternoon, commissioners, staff, and guests. It's nice to see you all again. I don't think I've seen your faces since COVID, so it's good to see your faces again. I'm happy to be here. As Mr. Gerber said, I think you guys got used to me presenting a pretty standard report for RAD every month. You became used to seeing the same thing and reporting on the same data. So I'm going to try and do that here as well. Andrea, do I have controls?
Moving you right now.
Thank you.
And you're now the presenter.
Can you see my screen?
We sure can.
Yes. All right. So the first slide that I want to show you, again, with the idea being that we'll update this every month, is a very simple revenue and expense slide. The most basic information that I can give you related to finance. So as you can see, revenue, $49.5 million. Expenses, close to $48.5 million, with a provision for reserve of just under $1 million. This comes directly from the report that you receive as part of your monthly report. I didn't change the format at all. So the same information that you've always been used to seeing is what was provided to you with this month's report. As Mr. Gerber said, we may expand this as time goes on, but I thought I would start with the basics for you to begin with. I also wanted to talk to you a little bit about what I am working on. I've been in the position about 2.5 weeks, I guess. And so there are definitely some things that are front of mind for me and for my very capable, outstanding staff. The first thing that we're working on is the fiscal year 2020 audit. Berman Hopkins will be our auditors again this year. I've worked with Sean and Brian in other capacities and have been touching base with them on a very regular basis as we prepare for this. BDO has helped us the last couple of years with audit prep, and they are helping us again this year. So I value very much their experience with this, and they're doing a great job in helping us to get ready. SHCC's unaudited financials are due to HUD by 9/27. So that's the deadline that we are sprinting towards right now. The final audit deadline for the final audit from Berman is 12/31. So this next quarter will be a busy one for us as we work with Berman Hopkins on that task. I heard Pilar mention the budget amendment. We are working on the budget amendment now. We expect to have that ready to present to you next month. Another thing that we're working on right now is budgets for the PBRA RAD properties. We have always, or since we converted to RAD, we've been dealing with two fiscal years. Some properties were with a 12/31 fiscal year end, and some properties had a 3/31 fiscal year end that aligned with the Housing Authority's fiscal year. We made the decision this year to change them all to a 12/31 fiscal year end. Tax credit properties are required to have a 12/31 year fiscal year end. So in order to make them all consistent, we had to go with 12/31. So that means that we will have budgets for you that will be effective January 1st of 2021 just for the RAD PBRA properties. So I'm working with Sylvia and Michael Ross and Nancy McElhaney on preparing those, and we'll have those for you. It will probably be the December board meeting that will present those. We also submitted applications to HUD, the HUD Multifamily Office, as opposed to the Public Housing Office, to recoup some of the cost related to COVID-19. That was about $323,000 in requested additional funds. We haven't heard anything from them. We haven't gotten a timeline from them, but we know that they are actively reviewing them. We hope to get some good news on that soon. Another project that we're working on immediately now and probably for the next 6 to 9 months is implementing additional modules in our Yardi software. Yardi is the software that we moved to when we did the RAD conversions. We implemented on the property management side, but we didn't implement much of it on the finance side. So we will be working to implement modules in fixed assets, accounts payable, procurement. If anyone on this call has ever been part of any kind of software conversion, you know, it sounds easy and it never is. So there'll be a lot of effort put into that software conversion. I'm very optimistic that it's going to increase our efficiency primarily, but also our accuracy and our reporting ability. So excited about that. Not looking forward to the work, but excited about the result. We're also just generally working on additional training and process improvements. We've already done some work with the LIH department, training on requisitions and invoicing. We're setting up some additional cross-training with LIH to train the finance staff a little bit more in what they do so we can understand how our departments work together. And so that's going to be something that's going to be ongoing. And then finally, something that I'm going to be working on over the next couple months is developing a reserve schedule to provide to you all as part of my regular monthly reporting. In addition to the unrestricted cash on hand that we always report on, the Housing Authority has significant reserves. They're restricted reserves, but they have significant reserves that we can draw on for a variety of things. The one that comes to mind most immediately for me, since RAD was my world until not too long ago, is the replacement reserves that we had to put in place for all of the RAD properties. We have $35 million that is available to us to do capital repairs on the RAD property. So understanding that resource is I think an important part of understanding the Housing Authority's financial situation. So I'm happy to entertain any questions, but I'm just really happy to be reporting to you all in this capacity and look forward to working with you.
Thanks, Ann.
I've got a couple of questions. That's a nice report for somebody that has such a basic understanding like I do. And of course, you always hear me talk about Thomas asking how much we got in the unreserved. And he thought, well, we got 1 million, 2 million, 3 million. Well, I like an accountant using his fingers. When you talked about, the reserves, explain, I know you've explained this before, but explain to me where that $35 million has come from, the reserves for RAD. Ann, I can't hear you.
Sorry about that. I'm trying to be diligent about muting my line. The replacement reserves out of each RAD deal came out of the deal. So in most cases, we borrowed that money, and it was part of the loan that we took out. It was a required reserve, and it was created based on a needs assessment and a formula that HUD put together.
Now, are we paying interest on it, or is it like a line of credit?
We are paying interest on the loan.
Okay. Is there any way we could do it where we didn't? I guess that's part and parcel of the whole loan, so. In that case, there's no way we could separate that or renegotiate the deal where that becomes the line of credit and satisfies everybody. Is there any way to do that?
You know, Ron might be able to comment on that. I know that strictly speaking, at this point, we do have a prepayment penalty that we would have to pay to make that happen. Ron, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a requirement by HUD, and there's no way around that unless we were to actually fund that initial replacement out of our own cash. So I guess if there's a silver lining on it, it's a 30 to 35 year amortization on those initial reserves. So you know, the punitive side of making our payments go up isn't great, but it is a requirement. It is part of the initial loan sizing when we're doing the original plan. That's correct. I think the other thing I could add to that just real quickly is that we're also every month in our mortgage payment that we send in to our lender, we are putting additional required reserves basically in equal to about $300 a unit per year that will continue to keep replacing that reserve account. So while it's not going to be $35 million, it does have a plan of long-term where every month there's so much money per unit per year going into that replacement reserve. So it's always sort of set to replace itself over the life of the property.
But there wouldn't be interest owed on money we put back in the reserve.
That's correct. That's not anything. But it is part of our mortgage payment. But it's not an interest thing. It's just a required cost to put into the replacement reserve.
Okay. Clark, did you want to chip in on the legal part of that? No,
Barry. I think Barry's probably using his son's computer because it says Clark Palmer and it's really Barry Palmer.
I thought maybe Clark was his real name and he just tells me.
He goes by Clark Kent most of the time, but except when he's lawyering.
That's good. That's
Barry, you're on mute. Barry, you're on mute.
So.
You're still on mute.
That's okay. I thought there might be a legal issue there. I think Ann and Ron have answered it.
Barry, you figured it out. Now you can talk.
So I think you all get the idea that we're going to be trying to have more in-depth finance briefings, like you just heard from Ann, over time. And so the next one, we will schedule a full-on budget and audit committee meeting in October, and so with Chairman Bailey and Vice Chair Carrington's approval to do that, we'll plan to schedule that, and we'll have a more in-depth discussion then. And then but even still, in the monthly board meetings, we're going to still provide you with sort of the numbers you need to know, and give you a sense of what's coming forward and what projects are moving forward within finance, because I think it's important. You need to know where the money is coming from. You need to know where the money is going, and you need to have a sense of the reserves and feel a good sense of the financial health and the safety and protections that we've built in into the system. It's not just the $17 million that you see represented as a reserve. But it's the, you know, $11 million for just the acquisition properties that Ron's got. It's the $30+ million that Ann's got. But they all play off of each other, and we're responsible for a large, for a very, very large portfolio, and we have to be good stewards of it. And being good stewards of it, first and foremost, means watching the finances of it. So, Ann, thank you for that report. And if there's no other comments on the report, I'd love to turn more over to the development end of it and the AAHC work, and that would be, I think, chaired appropriately, Mr. Chairman, by Commissioner Carrington.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Do you all want to go to item 4 of HACA's agenda? Would that be the next item?
I think we need to go to the Affordable Housing Corporation first and then go to the Public Facilities Corporation, and we come back to HACA to approve it last.
Okay. And so, Mr. Chairman, then on item 4, which was the update on acquisition and development programs, we will not do that right now.
Actually, I think if you want to, we can do the update from Ron, and then we can go to take the action item on the Montecito and the other developments next. But if Ron wants to go ahead and give the update now, or okay, either Ron or Ann give the update now, we can go ahead and take that.
Actually, I'll do a quick one on the acquisition side, and Suzanne will talk real briefly on the construction piece. Good afternoon, commissioners and Mr. Gerber, guest staff. Just to let you know, our current portfolio is staying very strong. I'm real proud of our management staff and the things that they've been able to do to hold things together. We're averaging this month for September, we're at just 98.1% of our rent collected. We've never missed a beat. Fortunately, we've been very blessed that we've been able to collect our rents and people have paid and have worked very carefully with us on payment agreements and we've been very, very cooperative with them. We haven't had a single eviction. Obviously, they were suspended, but we've had very, very good relationships with our tenants. We're averaging between 96 to 97% occupied. Some sites are getting a lot of traffic. Others are a little slower. Just depends on the time. But for the most part, we're meeting our obligations very easily. We're putting additional monies away in reserves above and beyond what we've agreed to with our investors or with our lenders. So we're very well capitalized for the future. And I don't really have anything negative to say at this point on our acquisitions. I think everything's been going really well. One thing I did want to point out, because Jimmy was talking about the office building, and I don't know if you all know this, but as of this month, and I think we had one little minor payment. I think it was done, but I think the office building, 1124 South IH-35, is now free and clear of debt. So we own that.
There's one more small piece of paper that I have to fill out, Ron, and it will be so.
Okay, so I think it's a little small amount, but I guess I'll say by the end of September we'll own that. So that was something that I thought was pretty good because this is a very valuable building in a great location and with a lots of potential and we've taken quite a bit of rent revenue from the city, and so that will now go toward which is usually paying the mortgage payment. Now that'll our bottom line into our unrestricted cash to use for other things. So we're real excited about that.
Ron, when did we acquire the building?
We acquired the building, I want to say, in 2009, I believe. Wasn't it 2009, 2008?
I think it was 06.
Oh, was it 06?
It's 2005.
I think we refinanced. Oh, I'm sorry. Refinanced it in 09. That's correct. That's correct. It was vacant. It was occupied by Progressive Insurance at the time when they vacated. So it was moved over to the Met Center.
And I'll jump in with our construction and new construction portfolio. We've done really well.
Suzanne, if you don't mind, just for one second, let me just say this real quick. I want to make sure you know I was not recognizing you, but Ryan's name was on the agenda item. Otherwise, I would have recognized you and Ron together. So I just want to make sure you knew I was not trying to slight you by not recognizing you.
No, we're partners. I get it. on the construction side, as you said, there is some concerns with COVID out there. We've been very, very lucky. We've implemented some really tight controls on all of our sites. The workers have to go through the temperature checks, the questionnaires. The closest we've gotten to anything is one new worker was coming on site, said he had had COVID. We sent him home and said, do not come back to the site till you have a negative test. He went immediately, got the negative test, and we were fine. We've done very well, you know, with the exception of the normal rain in Austin. I do want to point out some really exciting news. Chairman Ritchie, you remember our grand opening out at Goodnight at the beginning of the year. We started leasing 304 units last year. As of the end of August, we are at 100% occupancy. So that's how many months in a pandemic that we are in lease-up that we have been able to get to 100%. So I'm very proud of our management companies. And the rest of our properties are doing really well. We're really excited about it.
Suzanne, who's the management company on Goodnight?
It is Capstone. And if you'll remember, we're under construction on Moonlight, which is right next, right behind Goodnight. So this fares very well with what the demand is going to be. And I looked at once Moonlight is complete next year, I think we're going to really lease up fast.
So I'm trying to figure out where I heard this. But what I understand is, despite the pandemic, we still are having more than 100 people move into Austin almost every day or a week. I forget whether it's a day or a week. But in essence, the in-migration that we're having, that we had before COVID, it hasn't stopped. It's still, we've got people still moving here, coming here. And so the demand for housing is still at where it was at pre-COVID levels, as I understand. But I did see something. It was a news article, and I forget which publication, because I have way too many publications. But I did see where some of the market rate developments were starting to reduce rents for the first time in some time. Ryan, can you or Suzanne elaborate on that? Because that, I was surprised by that, given that what I had read and heard is that there's still a very robust demand for housing.
Sure, I could tell you real quickly, especially in the downtown area, the drive to be paying these high rents in these downtown market rent properties where you were close to bars, you know, nightlife, these high-profile apartments that have six-floor service bars and outdoor swimming pools. And so people were excited to be in the heart of that and paying $3 a square foot. When when COVID kicked in, a lot of these people started going, wait a minute, I don't have use of these amenities. I can't use these high profile gyms. Why am I paying $3 a square foot when I can get just as nice an apartment and sit in there versus paying $3 a square foot? And they started saving some money doing that. And I think you've seen some of the demand shift away, and it's put a lot of some pressure on the new market rent units, but it's increased the demand on the affordable side because a lot of those apartments are now absorbing some of the fallout from people just, you know, being more frugal with their spent expenses, realizing that they're paying for amenities that they don't know when they're going to be able to use again. So the leasing is drastically slowed down in some of these very, very high profile apartments. And that's why you're starting to see some concessions. They're getting some free rent. They're trying to drop rents a little bit just to keep the doors open. Yeah, that's been the one hardest hit in Austin has been the very high end market units. Absolutely.
That makes sense, and that puts us in a position, in a better position with our properties.
And I don't know, maybe I think a lot of, in our portfolio, we're very understanding of the residents that we're serving and taking care of, and I think that communication has given our residents that comfort that, you know, that we're there, we're not this, you know, mean developer that's going to boot you out if you can't pay your rent. And we've been able to have very good cohesiveness with our tenants that's kept our occupancy strong and very, very small amounts of transition and moving in our apartments. So, you know, we're pretty happy with the way our occupancy has trended through these last 6 months. It's been pretty solid. I did talk to CDT. We had a big state of the Austin Union with their executive team, and they did communicate with me that we are outperforming their entire portfolio across the country. So we're an anomaly, I think. A lot of places across the country are suffering a lot harder than what, you know, obviously we're doing well. But he said by far and away, they're not, you know, we have none of the problems that they're incurring in other sets of especially in cities like New York where they have investments, Chicago. He mentioned, I want to maybe even think Atlanta. I can't remember now some of the towns where they're invested in are really hurting on occupancy. So they didn't want to make note that we were the strongest portfolio that they had in their program.
So you say that Austin and Seattle are kind of unique in among cities that just are defying every metric that's out there and just every sort of known sort of economic force. We just are so far beyond kind of what you would expect in this time. Wasn't Seattle kind of the other city? Is that sort of the?
That was it. It wasn't Atlanta. It was Seattle. Yes, sir.
It's Seattle. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had the same question that Carl had. I read the same article, and you know, my ongoing concern for the past several years is Austin gets overbuilt and the rates all go down, and then how does that affect us? And that seemed to be what that article was saying. It said that there's been so much building that people are having to adjust and come down. If it becomes true in the future, how does that affect us, or does it affect us?
Well,
if apartment rents go down,
let's look at it this way. I guess in the acquisition sites that are not tax credit dependent, we're very low leverage. We're very low leverage, so we're able to sustain. I mean, we're already below. So let me put it this way: we're already below where most of the market is today. So while many apartment complexes, and especially on the market side, are trending downward or dropping rents, we're still at a point where our rents are below where they're dropping to. So we're a safe place in the near future. I also can tell you that we're very low leveraged, so that in the worst case scenario, and we always look at worst case scenarios when doing this, we can carry our debt services across the board if we were maybe even 70 to 75% occupied. That trending in Austin. In fact, in the tax credit side, where Suzanne's working so hard with the investors, they are flocking to Austin because they know the demand for affordability is going to be huge moving forward. And I will tell you, we're going to talk about the Montecito a little bit and Tallwood, which you approved last month. I mean, we were competing with 35 other investment groups trying to bid for these properties. Montecito had 27 different offers. People are still, and these are pretty smart groups. I mean, big time national companies that are coming in and still feeling very, very good about Austin, Texas. So I think while I agree with what Commissioner Ritchie said about the market, you know, the high end market rent, I have not seen that come down to our levels at all. But again, we are still a step or two even below that, and we're still doing very well because of our leverage situation. I've been feeling pretty good.
CU, you got something you want to question, comment? Edwina?
Yes, sir.
You have a question?
No, I don't.
Okay, all right.
I do have a question. Are we ready to move on to Austin Affordable Housing Corporation?
Yes. Thanks a lot, Suzanne.
Thank you.
Stay close, guys. We will now move to the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation tab in your board book. And Chairman Ritchie did call this meeting. He opened this meeting when he opened our Housing Authority board meeting. But I'd like to call it to order at 1:52 p.m. And we need to certify the quorum. So, Chairman Ritchie?
Present.
Commissioner Bailey? Duncan Hall?
Present.
Apostolo? Mary? She's here. And Commissioner Farrington. The next item is citizens' communication. So do we have someone that is interested in providing citizen communication to the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation meeting? Okay. If not, we will move then to the first consent item, which is the approval of the minutes of July the 16th, 2020.
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes from the July 16, 2020 board meeting.
Thank you. Is there a second? Okay. Any comments, questions about those minutes? If not, all in favor by aye.
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 And any opposed? Okay, thank you. The next item on our agenda is an action item for the approval of Resolution 00162, and this authorizes Austin Affordable Housing Corporation to execute any and all documents or take any action that's necessary or desirable to participate in the housing tax credit application for Walnut Trace Apartments. So this is item 2 of AAHC, and Suzanne will be presenting this item.
Good afternoon, board, commissioners, staff, and guests. This item is the first time, or this is the first time you're seeing Walnut Trace Apartments. This is a partnership with LDG. The property is located in the Austin extraterritorial jurisdiction, which means it's right outside the city limits. It's 9.88 acres, and it is located in a qualified census tract, which means that we get a boost in the calculation for tax credits, which is a good thing. We will be doing bonds on this one. It is located close to LBJ, or it serves LBJ High School, Martin Middle School, and Norman Crossing Elementary. This area is really starting to grow. Endeavor is actually looking, they're a big market rate developer. They are proposing to develop a market rate apartment complex pretty close to this one. So we're kind of hoping we can piggyback off of that, and people that can't afford the to rent at their apartment complex can come over to ours. Now this one, as I said, this is the first time you're seeing it. This just starts the process. We have a very, very long process on this. We aren't looking to close on this one until the fiscal year 21-22. And we will bring this back to you two more times. This property will use the income averaging for tax credits. We'll serve units 50%, 60%, and 70% area median family income. Because we're so new on this, the number of units for AMI area is going to change. So when I bring this back to you for the final resolutions, I'll make sure that I have unit counts for each of those AMI levels. We do have a really healthy breakdown on units. We've got some 3 bedrooms, which I really like, about 63 of them, and 2 4-bedrooms. And as with all of our properties that we have committed to you, that we will accept housing choice vouchers. We will not ever bring you a property that does not accept housing choice vouchers. And I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions for Suzanne?
I've got a couple of questions. Suzanne, that last thing you said, that y'all promise us that we'll always take housing vouchers. Mm-hmm. If we own it and we're also in charge of housing vouchers, who's to stop us?
Well, they're tenant vouchers, so the tenant has the right to go anywhere to use them. So, you know, some landlords in Austin do not accept vouchers. There have been developers that have approached us that said we don't want to have vouchers in our properties,
in this instance, we're the landlord, so that's not a problem for properties that we own, is it?
No, not at all. That's why I kind of started with there. We have been approached by developers that wanted to partner with us, like LDG, but they didn't want us to accept vouchers in our properties, and we told them that they could go find other partners because that's not the business that we do.
And then the second question I have, and I don't really know who to direct this to other than maybe legal counsel, and this is something on down the road. on our property that we're either purchasing or that's just part of our stuff, is there any problem if the state goes with, the governor has decided that if we defund the police department, that he's going to take away the power of cities to accession new parts. So mess with various, I can't think of all the terms, but if they go in and retroactively, and people can come in and vote to take themselves out of the city, will that affect any of our business, top to bottom, if suddenly it's not in our jurisdiction anymore? Has anybody thought about that yet?
There was an effort some years ago, Barry might even touch on this, in San Antonio, to remove the tax exemption from affordable housing properties, and it caused a firestorm when it happened. Again, that was in Bexar County, San Antonio. I think that it would be hard to remove or to have much impact on existing commitments that have been made, the existing exemptions. But going forward, I would think it very well might, and that would certainly change our business model if the city is no longer empowered, and Travis County appraisal district is no longer empowered to give exemptions. If that's been preempted by the state, or there's other terms, that would impact it. I would think. Barry, what are your thoughts, and Ron?
Let me just say this, Mike. One, I think in terms of retroactive, I think you would have state would have a hard time from a legal standpoint, Chuck, because I think you're trying to abridge an existing contract. And I think the Tejas deal back in 1995 sort of set the precedent for the state that, if there's an existing contract, you can't go in and abridge it. But I think Mike is right going forward. The state could pass a law that prohibited appraisal districts from granting the tax exemption. But I think, politically, I think that would be, cutting off the, as I just said, the one thing that the governor's office is seeing, they're trying to attract people to come to Texas in terms of business. But a lot of those folks are not going to be staying in high luxury inn establishments downtown. They're going to be staying in single family developments or in multifamily developments. And I think the governor's office last session, when Mike and I met with Louise, acknowledged that they need more affordable developments as people move in, because not everybody is going to be the CEO making $1 million a year. A lot of these employees who are moving in with these companies, I mean, they're mid-management and they're looking for affordability. And that's the one thing that Austin has, that's the one thing that Austin struggles with is affordability. Houston is far more affordable than Austin. Dallas is far more affordable. But to the extent that we're trying to attract businesses and they want to come here because UT, the music scene, the housing market has to also play a role in terms of being affordable, and we're helping meet that niche.
I don't know that I agree with the governor being that amenable to taking care of Austin. Houston, yeah. It was resolved in bankruptcy court. So there's still a question of whether or not you can do away with an existing contract. But we're certainly putting the cart before the horse here. But the current state leadership isn't too concerned about doesn't seem to be too concerned about unintended consequences, as long as they get what they want politically. And I just think it's something we need to take into consideration.
I think it's a legitimate concern, Chuck.
And I think it's probably more complicated than I've made it. I think there may be some, every time they change the property association law, they interfere with contracts. And they don't seem to be too worried about private contracts, despite the Constitution says they can't do it. Anyway, it may not affect us, but when I was reading about it, I thought, there's no longer an ETJ. There's people come in and vote themselves out of the city. It just raises questions, I guess is all I'm saying. And I think it's based on the current leadership of the state. I think it's a concern for Austin.
I think it is. I think there's, you know, I think we always have to remember there's going to be, you know, really low income people who are going to need housing, and the rules may change, but I think if we go back retroactively and impact commitments that have been made, and that affects city, state, and federal commitments, that would be really disconcerting to not just government that was happening because you had governmental entities, you know, going back, but the fact that the whole housing finance system is balanced off of it, I think would be very, very unsettling.
Well, the governor doesn't seem to worry too much about unsettling the city off.
Yeah.
So there may be all kinds of legal and constitutional issues. It's just something that I think we need to be aware of and stay on top of. I think it'd be a mistake if we don't.
Well, I agree with you, Chuck. And like I said, again, I think it's a legitimate concern. I think the governor and others are concerned about the governance structure with the city. But in terms of people who live in the city, the businesses that are here, I think they are pretty clear in terms of trying to make that distinction. They're focused more on the governance aspect and those who are in leadership and figuring out a way to sort of change that structure without sort of going into penalizing folks who actually live here. But like you said, it's a very complicated issue. And so, you know, I think it's a legitimate concern, and I think Mike will, Mike, one of the reasons why we hired Mike is because he's politically astute, among other things, and he has good relationships with Luis and others, and he has this, Instagram. So, but I do think it's a legitimate issue that you raise and everything, and I think it's something that Mike and his team will continue to monitor and follow.
Okay, made my point.
Thank you. Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Chairman Ritchie. Any other questions for Suzanne before we take a motion and a vote on Resolution 00162? Okay, then hearing no more questions, then what the Board of AAHC is being asked to do is approve Resolution 00162, and that is to allow AAHC to execute any and all documents or take any other action that's necessary or desirable to participate in the housing tax credit application for Walnut Trace Apartments. Do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Okay. Thank you all. All right, we will move now to item number 3 on Austin Affordable Housing Corporation's agenda. And Suzanne will be presenting this, and it is to approve Resolution 00163 to take any and all action and execute any and all documents that's necessary or desirable to participate in the housing tax credit application for Belmont Apartments. Suzanne, take it away.
This Belmont Apartments is also a new one. This is the first time you're seeing it. It's just to get our foot in the door and start finishing up the planning, getting our third-party reports, trying to get building permits, site plans. This is also a partnership with LDG. This one is located behind our bridge at Cameron. Bridget Cameron is in lease up right now. It's 263 units and we're 17% occupied. We just started leasing about 2 months ago, so we feel really good about that. The Belmont is going to be a smaller
addition to it. It's going to be 144 units. This one is located in the city limits of Austin. It's 8 acres. And if the schools that will serve it are Maynard High School, Decker Middle School, and Pioneer Crossing. We will do income averaging on this one as well. So we'll have units at 50%, 60%, and 70% area median income. Again, when we bring it back for final resolutions and we have everything buckled down, I will give you unit counts for each of those AMIs as well. The unit breakdown is very spread out. It's 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms and 8 4 bedrooms, so I really like that count. We are seeing that we need a lot more 3 and 4 bedrooms. And this one as well, we will be accepting housing choice vouchers on it. I would be happy to answer any questions y'all have.
Suzanne, as the developers approach you and talk about potential new developments, do you all work with them to encourage them to do larger units, the 3 and 4 bedroom units? I know certainly a lot of that's determined by the market study, but how much influence does staff have in helping them develop that unit mix?
They, when a new developer comes on board, I do let them know that we are looking for some larger units. I understand that, you know, it depends on the size of the site, the feasibility, whether it's going to pencil out with those unit sizes. But a developer like LDG, who I've worked with for a long time, they do know. I mean, we have those conversations. And any time that they can provide those larger units, they definitely do. And the new developers, they learn really quick that what we want and what we need in order to do business with them.
And I'll just add real quickly, Commissioner, that I think we do have some pretty strong influence over them. And I mean, Suzanne and I both, I mean, when we talked to our colleagues downstairs in Lisa's shop in the voucher program, you know, the biggest need is that single mom with two kids, or the biggest need is that single mom with two or three children, or a family with and that can't afford a house. And so, you know, because of the change of times from where we started back in the 80s to where we are now, you know, it's hard to put three kids in one bedroom. And if we're going to serve the people that we want to serve and our stakeholders, it's to me, we balance the portfolio. We're going to bring you properties that are only serving one bedrooms and two bedrooms, but it's paramount to continue to balance that with these larger units that we can cater to the families that we serve. I think we carry a lot of wealth. I mean, you know, we're the ones that make this deal work. And so I think we're very, very deliberate and very strong about how we approach some of these developments, based on size and based on some market conditions, of course. But we're always focusing on it because our thought is our families and especially the voucher holders that we know that are in the biggest demand based on what we hear from customers. So we'll continue to fight for those larger units because I think they're critical, because housing is so out of control right now. And there's no next step as your family grows. You can't, transition out now if you're a low-income resident. You have to have these larger units. So I'm trying to make that comfortable, them as comfortable as we can. So we do push for bigger sizes, I think. And for the most part, the people that we're working with listen to us. You know, you don't know the ones that Suzanne and I have turned away in the last 2 months of several deals that we refused to pay for. So anyway, I think that's a great question, and we do not just let them come in and say, here's what we're doing, here's the plan, and here's how we're going through this. So we do have some pretty strong input.
Okay, thank you, Ron. Are there any other questions for Suzanne or Ron? Okay. I would like to call your attention to it would be 5 of 5, but it's after 4 of 5. It's an attachment that does, it's a map, and it shows where our properties are located in this particular area, Belmont, Bridget, Cameron. So I always appreciate these maps because I think they're really important for us to put it into perspective of where our properties are located. Okay, if there are no more questions for Suzanne or Ron, then I would ask for a motion for the approval of resolution 00163. So this would be to execute any and all documents or take any other action that's necessary or desirable to participate in the housing tax credit application for Belmont Apartment. Do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, thank you. I think this is maybe because these two transactions are with LDG, and as you all know, we have a number of transactions with LDG. If you look at the chart, the map that's in the front of your book in the flap, I think we have 11 with LDG, and as Susanna said, this is the very first step in moving through on these transactions, but we were doing a significant number of transactions with LDG, and over the last year, we've talked about and staff's talked about making sure that we are comfortable with the financial and the operational capacity of LDG. So staff, along with Berman Hopkins, has put together a draft scope of work that would be looking at both the financial capacity and the operational capacity as LDG as we continue our exposure with them. I think the draft has just come out. I've not looked at it, but we will be doing that to give us all comfort that as we continue work with LDG, that they will continue to be a strong financial and operational partner for us. Mike, Warren, is there anything you all want to say in regards to that?
We appreciate how willing LDG was to work to provide this to us. They'll do so at their cost, but it'll be information that will be given to us and give us a sense of a number of things. We'll provide you all with the list of what they're going to look at, but in general, it's the auditors will look at their schedule of financial and operational capacity from LDG as of June 30th. They'll then be looking, doing some different testing procedures on bank investments, on the various bank review, the bank investment statements, looking at receivables and other assets, contractual commitments, contingencies and lawsuits, liabilities and obligations. They're going to compare the schedule to other metrics and perform some ratio analytics and benchmarking to the industry. They're going to look at some other things that are necessary to determine the financial wherewithal of LDG, including obtaining a schedule of existing contracts and the percent complete, the backlog schedule that they have, confirm any surety and bonding agents, confirm with surety and bonding agents on the current capacity, evaluate if there's anything on LDG's staffing side, look at the properties that they own and manage, including staffing levels and occupancy levels, just to make sure that all things are well there, and then really anything else that would that we need to assist in determining their potential for further development projects. So we're gonna give them a pretty good term. We're gonna be getting a colonoscopy, and that's a good thing. And hopefully they'll get the clean bill of health. We have confidence in that. We appreciate their transparency and working with a third party audit firm to review this information, and I think that'll give the board quite a bit of comfort. If there are specific things, we forwarded this to Commissioner Carrington in her role as chair of AHC. If there's any other commissioners who would like to take a look at these items to see if there's other things we wish to add. But Ron and I and Suzanne have scrubbed it. We have not sent it to LDG yet, but we will be sending it over, you know, before the end of the week, or early next week. You know, it's fine. But if you do have any other thoughts or things you'd like to see, just to make sure that everything is well, this is a great opportunity to do that. And I think they're excited about providing it as well. I think they, when I talked to Chris Dischinger at LDG, he was pleased to, you know, he said, you know, you want your partner to know you're as good as you say they are, just as we want people at HACA, you know, we work with, you know, outside of HACA, we want our partners to know that we're as good as we are. And that's why we put such emphasis on, you know, getting the operations right and the financials right and the controls right. So that's all I would add to it. Ron, anything you'd add? Okay.
You summed it up exactly right.
Edwin, I've got a question.
Yes, Chuck.
It seems to me like the meal's already out of the barn on this deal. We've already got, I don't know how many deals with them, but so the question I have is two questions is, what's our remedy if we don't like what we see when it comes back? And secondly, when we entered into these original contracts, didn't we already do some due diligence so we don't have to worry about what something bad comes back?
Absolutely. We did quite a bit of due diligence beforehand, and we've been working with them throughout. This is really an opportunity for, again, a third-party auditor, given the size of our work with them, to go and take a deeper dive into their books and their financial wherewithal and provide an additional layer of assurance beyond what Ron and Suzanne are able to provide, and what the attorneys and syndicators, you know, everyone is asking for very detailed information. So it's not just Ron and Suzanne, it's the syndicators and the lenders and all the others who are associated with the transaction, reviewing LDG's health. And if, you know, so there are lots of things in the system that are tripwires. And so we would see that there. What we're really looking at is their whole portfolio and making sure that, you know, they're now post, you know, we've got five deals on the ground with them that we're currently, you know, operating. And we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 under construction with them. We want to make sure that we feel as, you know, feel like they're strong as we believe them to be.
So my question is, what do we do if we get something back we don't like?
I think that'd be a conversation we'd be having with investors and with LDG directly, and we'd ask them to remedy those things.
It's one of those kind of things. Be careful what you ask for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've already got deals we're doing with them. We've got new deals that we're working with them on, and I assume we want to do some more deals in the future. And so the future things would take care of themselves, but I just think we need to think about, well, we're asking for it. What if we get something we don't like?
We might, but I think the risk is worth the benefit that we get.
I'm not worried about the risk, and that's why we're doing it. But what's our remedy? I guess is what I'm asking. If we see something we don't like, and they said this has been this way since the very beginning, we're not going to change.
May I jump in for a moment, Mr. Gerber?
Yes, ma'am.
You know, I think, Chuck, that our remedy would be, we're not doing any more deals with you. Yes, we've done this many, but things have shown up now that make us uncomfortable, make us doubt continuing as a partner with you. And,
that's what I said. We've got a remedy going forward. What do we do if we find out that the real owners are Italian named guys that live in New York City? I mean, you know, and this is the lawyer talking. You know, there are things that might just pop up and say, oh, well, we weren't aware of that. Can y'all do something about it? Nope, we're not going to do anything about it.
Well, the properties here in Austin, for instance, are doing okay when we're strong and things are well.
Ron, it's a rhetorical question.
Yeah, I know. But we do have remedies. And I think, I mean, have remedies in the partnership agreement that give us the ability, like if we discovered they were fraudulent, I mean, they could be removed as the partner. And just as, you know, just as if we committed some act of fraud, they can, you know, remove us as general partner. And there are some legal remedies for situations that will fail. I also would say if the properties ever did get in trouble or something ever did happen, they would get removed by the investor much quicker, and because they're not going to get rid of our tax exemption. If the property's got problems or something, that's what keeps the properties going, especially in bad times. So they're going to look to us to figure out a new partner, a new situation, and we'll have those, you know, we'll have that ability to deal with that. But there are some pretty
good that's a good answer. But we go back to the original contract, and of course, then I could argue, then why are we doing this? We've already got those protections built into the contract. And the answer, I guess, Edwin, would be going forward, we want to make sure we're as covered. But as long as we're covered in our existing contract, then I'm not worried what the answer is.
And I did say, Chuck, as you mentioned, I mean, we do, staff does their due diligence on all developers that we do business with. They do due diligence on developers we don't do business with because we don't like what shows up. I think the reason that I have encouraged Mike and Ron to move forward with doing something like this, it's one thing to have three or four transactions with one development partner, but as we get to 10, 11, 12 transactions with one development partner, then that's the reason I believe, and I have encouraged, that we take, as Mike calls it, a much deeper dive into their whole portfolio and to their financials and operations.
Yeah, I agree with you, Edwin. I don't have any problems with it. I just, yeah. Ron kind of set my mind at ease, as did Suzanne, when they said, we do our due diligence. We've got provisions in the contracts to take care of any problems that show up. So we're just taking a third step since we're doing some of that. I'm fine. That takes care of my issues.
Thank you. Are there any more questions, comments for staff? If not, then do I hear a motion that we approve resolution 00163, which would be for AAHC to execute any and all documents and take any and all action that's necessary or desirable participate in the housing tax credit application for Belmont Apartments. Do I hear a motion?
I so move.
Thank you, Mary. Chuck, was that you on the second?
Yeah, second.
Okay, second. Any more discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, thank you. The next item is item number 4 under Austin Affordable's agenda. And this is resolution 00164, again, authorizing AAHC to execute any and all documents or take any other action that's necessary or desirable to participate in the housing tax credit application for the Cypress Creek at Howard Lane Apartments. And as Suzanne has noted in her write-up, and she will tell you about this, this is the first opportunity we've had to partner with Bonner Carrington, no relation, no conflicts of interest, and it's a development company that's located here in Austin. So, Suzanne, would you present this, please?
Yes, thank you. Cypress Creek at Howard Lane, as Commissioner Carrington said, it's our first partnership with Bonner Carrington. They are a very experienced development company. We've been trying for years to be able to get a deal to work, and finally we're off and running with this one. This again is the first resolutions to get our foot in the door and start working on, you know, the process to closing. This one definitely will not close until fiscal year 2021 or 21-22. It is located in the city of Austin. It's a pretty large tract of land, 23, almost 24 acres. It is located right next to John B. Connolly High School, And I think I'm a broken record when it comes to, I really like our projects to be so close to the schools. It does serve Westview Middle School and Palmer Lane Elementary as well. There's a bus stop just right on Howard Lane and one on Metric. So I like that as well. This one, we're not going to do income averaging. We're going to just do a straight 100% of the units at 60% area median family income and below. It does have 1, 2, 3, and 4 bedrooms. There's an extra, 16 four-bedroom apartments. And we as well will accept housing choice vouchers. And we're really excited to be able to do this first deal with Bonner Carrington. They're from what all of the background we've got on them and our conversations, it's going to be an exciting deal. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Suzanne? Again, after the resolution, the last page, there is a map that shows you where this particular development is located, or will be located. So, if no more questions of staff, then we'll look for a motion to approve Resolution 00164, authorizing AAHC to execute any and all documents or take any other action it's necessary or desirable to participate in the housing tax credit application for Cypress Creek at Howard Lane Apartments. Do I hear a motion?
So moved.
And second, Tyra. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, thank you. And the last item under Austin Affordable Housing Corporation's agenda is Resolution 00165. And this is proposal for an acquisition of the Montecito Apartments. And there are four actions that you are asked to approve today. Facilitate the acquisition of the Montecito Apartments. Cause AAHC subsidiary, limited liability company, to own the development. Cause the owner to assume existing development financing. And cause AAHC and or the owner to execute any such further documents as necessary or desirable to allow the consummation of the transaction. You do have a resolution in your book, and it is my understanding from Ron and Mike that there are some changes to the resolution that you have in your board book for 00165. So, Ron, would you go through, I guess, the presentation of the acquisition first and then the changes in the resolution?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Again, good afternoon. Ron Kowal, Vice President, Asset Management, Housing Development. So this property itself is a 268 unit property called the Montecito. We're partnering with the Belveron Corporation once again. This is the same group that we approved the Tallwood Apartments to purchase with them, and that, by the way, will be closing next week, September 22nd. It's a property located just south of Old Torf. It's built in 1984. It's in very, very good condition. We're in the middle of almost at the end of our due diligence, I should say. We've walked a number of units throughout the property. Looks very good, very well cared for. It's one of those properties in this corridor, this transit corridor close to Riverside Drive, that is just being eyed on for a complete repurpose of higher rents and value add, as they like to call. Will they go in and do some improvements and they jack up the prices and displace a lot of residents. Belmaron Corporation is exactly that. This deal basically mirrors what we did on the Tallwood in terms of their commitment to affordability, not raising rents for 12 months, putting up an additional 1 year's worth of debt service coverage to make sure that we're adequately capitalized they're putting up a close to $2.5 million in capital expenses on top of that for, you know, necessary repairs down the road. Property is pretty, as we're finishing our lease audit, preliminarily we're looking at close to 100% of these residents all fall below the 80% median family income limits that are measured there. So it's a very affordable property. We're super, super excited about partnering with them again. I feel that they've been very easy and very good to work with. They've agreed to some pretty good tenant protections that we've asked them to do in terms of leasing, and obviously our bachelors are going to be more than welcome there. And so we're really excited about this deal. I think their mission is so well aligned with us, and their executive team is just fantastic to work with. This property will be their liability, not ours. So that's a good thing in that we're completely protected, even on the guarantee. We're not subject to those. So we got even a little bit stronger protections, just like we did on the Tallwood. And to address the change in resolution, this property was originally going to be, the debt was going to be required to be assumed. It's an assumption of the loan. And then as we went through this process, just as of yesterday, it's a Freddie Mac requirement that this owner has this property and the land is collateralized. So the loan, when Freddie has it, they package it and it goes as a collateralized loan. Our structure is the housing authority owns the land. Then the improvement is ground leased to the partnership, very typical structure. Freddie could not allow us to release the land out of the name of the owner because it's collateralized. So what we ended up doing is instead of assuming the loan and taking a supplemental, as I explained to you in the write-up, we were able to now take this loan out completely and get a new permanent loan at 2.4% interest for $31 million, not to exceed $32 million, and with 5 years of interest only. So it's an incredibly great rate that they quoted us because that they could not accommodate the original plan. So we're really excited about that. In fact, this has resulted in about a $300,000 a year windfall to our NOI, which we didn't expect. So we're very fortunate that it happened, and I apologize for these confusions. These real estate deals change. We probably should have been smart enough to think about on a collateralized loan. You can't take a land out of a collateralized loan. Freddie just doesn't allow you to do those types of things. So,
Ron, take a breath. Tyra has a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, got it. Okay. This is our third deal in this agenda that we're doing with Belron, and
second.
For each one, I thought it was the third. Okay, second. And in each, they're providing the same kind of financial arrangement. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And what are we putting in besides the land? Are we putting any cash into these deals at all?
No, ma'am. We're using our tax exemption as the basically the equity that goes into this transaction. So our financial benefit is coming at no cost for us putting in any of our unrestricted reserves.
Okay. Yeah, I think that answers.
Does that answer your question, Tyra?
Yes, thank you.
You good? Okay. Ron, sorry to interrupt, but.
Yes, ma'am.
I knew the commissioner wanted to ask that question. Okay, do you know where you left off?
Well, I got it.
Commissioner Bailey has a question.
Yes, sir. Just real quick. This company prides itself on preservation of workforce housing. What is workforce housing?
I think workforce housing in their definition, and I think more broad in a lot of definitions, is that level of income that falls somewhere between that 60 and 80% median family income. you see a lot of times where these tax credit units that Suzanne just presented, they're all at restricted income levels of 60% and below for the most part. And once that resident gets to 61% on his income, he can't recertify. He's forced to leave because he doesn't qualify as in a tax credit. So they have nowhere to go. They either have to go to a new. And what's happening in Austin is people that graduate, their incomes grow, they end up going to a market rent deal and paying 50% of their income because the rent is high. So what we try to do is balance that and find that missing middle component. 60% to 100% median family income is what really workforce housing is, but our portfolio really focuses on that 80% and below. So we're kind of in that 60 to 80% AMI range. So it gives people the ability to continue to grow and not kicked out and you know out of the tax credit deal. So it's that piece that fits in between the tax credits that serve 60% below and the market that serves over 120% of your AMI. So that's what they consider or we consider workforce housing.
Okay,
I might also add into it that the term workforce housing also is a little bit of a euphemism. More friendly term than just saying affordable housing. It was a way years ago to change the language to get away from saying that low-income people deserve a good place to live too. You know, the parents with single parents with kids, the disabled, seniors, persons with disabilities, and so shamefully that phrase has become a little bit more in use to kind of describe. Housing folks who, where it's a struggle to get housing, in for them. But I think we should talk openly. We're really proud at AHC that we serve folks who really wouldn't have great housing choices were it not for AHC. And so I just, that we're proud that on our list we have a large number of voucher holders. They're oftentimes excluded, from, market workforce housing, if you will. So it's, so I just want to add that clarification.
Any more questions for staff? Okay. If not, then I would like to request approval of resolution. Well, now wait a minute. We've got a revised resolution, Ron. Barry, do we? I mean, we're approving a slightly different, the resolution we're approving has slightly different wording.
So, Madam Chair, I think you would say that you want to, seeking approval of the substitute resolution, also numbered 00165, okay, to do all of these actions.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Yeah,
I will ask for approval of a motion for 00165 as a substitute resolution that would allow us to facilitate the acquisition, cause a subsidiary to own the development, cause the owner to assume existing financing, and cause the owner to execute any further documents necessary to allow the consummation of the transaction. So do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Okay, Commissioner Ritchie and Tyra, second. Any further discussion? Tyra, question? Discussion? Yes, ma'am.
It looks like Tyra's phone may have died.
Oh, she raised her hand. We'll wait for you, Tyra. Tyra, are you back in communication? Andrea, can you help us out here?
Yeah, Tyra, she can't hear us right now. Let me call her and get her back on the meeting with her phone.
Okay. Would this be a good time to take a break?
Yes.
Can we have like a 5-minute break?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Director.
We can just get up and leave when we won't do on these kind of meetings.
Well, we could, but.
I do. I mean, I go.
So I would make a motion we take a 5-minute recess.
I'll second that.
All right. Thank you.
Commissioners, are we about ready to convene? To convene?
Yes. As chair of the committee, I am. Is Chairman Ritchie going to be with us, or has he had to leave?
He will be with us.
Okay. Okay. Thanks. Then we will resume. We'll resume our meeting of the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation. The next item on our agenda is the meeting of the Austin Affordable PFC, our Public Facility Corporation. And I'm calling this again. Chairman Ritchie opened this meeting at the beginning, and I'm calling this meeting to order at 2:53 p.m. Chairman Ritchie, I'll call the roll. Chairman Ritchie? Duncan Hall?
Duncan, present.
Apostolo? And Bailey?
Here.
Okay, thank you. Next item is citizen communication. Is there anyone who would like to comment to the Austin Affordable Housing Public Facility Corporation? Hearing none, we will move on to the consent item, which is item number one, and this is approval of the board minute for the meeting that was held on July the 16th, 2020. Do I hear a motion?
I move approval.
I so move.
Thank you. And a second by Mary. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Thank you. All right, we will move to the action items for the Public Facilities Corporation. What you've previously done for the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation is on the three transactions, the ability for those to move forward and apply for an allocation of tax credits. So sort of step one, what you're doing on the action items on 2, 3, and 4 is to approve a filing with the Texas Bond Review Board for an allocation of private activity bonds, which is resolution 06. Declaring the Okay, if not, do I hear a motion for approval of 00077 resolution to apply to the Texas Bond Review Board for the Belmont Apartments? Do I hear a motion?
I so move.
Mary, second. And second by Commissioner Ritchie. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Okay. All righty, and the last item under the Public Facilities Corporation agenda is Resolution 00078, again, placed an application for private activity bonds to the Bond Review Board, and this is for Cypress Creek at Howard Lane Apartments. Suzanne?
This property is the one located on West Howard Lane. It's our first first property to do partner with Bonner Carrington. We are asking for $50 million and a bond inducement for 362 units.
Okay. Any questions of Suzanne? If not, do I hear a motion to approve Resolution 00078? Application to the board for private activity bonds. Thank you, Tyra. Is there a second?
I second.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? And so this draws to a close the Austin Affordable PSC, and I just realized that I didn't close Austin Affordable Housing Corporation. So let's close the PFC.
Okay.
Do I need a motion on that? At 3 o'clock? Okay. Many shut their head. Yes. All right. So a motion to close the Austin Affordable PFC.
So moved. All right.
Thank you. Second. Mary? Second. All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Okay. All right, so going back, let's close the meeting of the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation. Do I hear a motion to close that meeting? Thank you. Mary, a second. All in favor?
Aye.
No opposed. Okay. Thank you all. And I believe, Mr. Chair, I turn this back over to you.
All right. So then we go to item number five, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so the chair will entertain a motion to approve resolution number 2667, which is approving the actions by the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation, Austin Public Facilities Corporation related to the Montecito Apartments in Austin, Texas.
I so move.
Motion by Commissioner Apostolo.
Second.
Seconded by Commissioner Carrington. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Hearing none, the motion carries. We go to item number six, which is to approve resolution.
Mr. Chair, we actually voted on that already, and seven. So those are all the items on the agenda for today.
With that, we need to go into executive session. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, we do. Can I report out real fast on the President's report?
Sure.
Want to let you all know that we conducted yesterday diversity, equity, and inclusion training from the City of Austin's Equity Office. It was a wonderful training, and it complemented a training that was done about a month ago that some of you participated in with Adrian Todman from National NARO and with Lisa Baker, who used to work out in Sacramento area, heading up a housing authority there. We're really doing a lot of work in the DEI space, and we're trying to figure out what our commitment looks like, how we are managing to our values, and I'm really proud of the team that's taking such leadership and ownership of this very, very important work. So I do want to let you know that we did follow up to actually Mayor Adler's suggestion when he came to speak to us about 2 months ago to involve Brian Oakes with the city, who's the city's equity officer, and they and their wonderful team came and did a great training for us 2 hours yesterday, and very, very important and impactful. I also want to let you know that the University of Texas has just completed, the law school just completed a report that I'm going to share with you all on what are called public facility corporation deals. We've done two of them, both with NRP Group. And the University of Texas is the law school. They have a professor there who does very, very good research. She's analyzed all 27 deals across the state. And her ultimate contention is that the value of the tax exemption that the development community is getting doesn't match the benefits as well as they could that housing authorities are getting. So we're working through that. A number of deals in Houston, some in San Antonio, come up for criticism for Worth. I'm about 40 pages through the 65 pages of the document, and I'm not seeing anything that's pointing its finger at us. And they did look at our two deals. We were very transparent about that. But there are issues there that may be of interest to you. So I'll forward a copy of that study along. And there's a group of housing authorities, Houston, Fort Worth, and us, that are going to be, and Barry Palmer, Clark Palmer, today, who will be working to work with Professor Heather Way at UT Law School to see where we're going moving forward and whether the PFC approach is a good approach or if it needs reform or if it should just be scrapped. For our two deals, though, we feel very good about them. We feel like they're safe deals. There's no safety issue. It's just, are the ratios of, how much the developer gets versus how much the PHA gets in public benefit, are they as balanced as they could or should be? So an interesting report that I'll share with you. The last thing that we didn't talk about in the COVID discussion was the Rent 2.0 program. This is a program that we are running with the city, jointly with CVR. It's $12.9 million in rental assistance. It's a big program, and it is rolling out. We've had almost 5,000 families apply for rental assistance and eviction prevention, and so we feel very good about how we're processing those folks and working through eligibility. And now finally starting to move money, which is, of course, the most important part of it. But I wanted you to know that, in general, things are going well. And when we go to the next program review committee, or maybe even during the regular board meeting next month, we'll give you a little bit more of an update and a little more flavor of that program, because it's a big program. When we did Rent 1.0, it was an all-consuming thing. By doing it jointly with CVR, we've leveraged a lot of capacity. But it's an all-consuming thing right now for Pilar Sanchez and for Kelly Crawford, and Ann Gass has been heavily involved in it as well, because a lot of money is running through our finance shop. So just want to give you the heads up on that program. Well, we are in the middle of it, and it's all going generally well. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would just say, any questions, and we'd be glad to go in the executive session.
A question, Mike. How much money in total was there for this program?
$12.9 million for round two. There was $1.3 million for round one.
Wow. And so what you expect then, on the average, how much money did an applicant receive?
So the city sets the parameters, and if a family is making under 30% because of COVID, then the family is actually eligible to receive up to 3 months of rental assistance. They have to be requalified each month, but once they are, if they're chosen and they're successful in this lottery process, then if they're under 30%, they can receive up to 3 1-month payments of their rent. If they're making over 30%, up to 80%, the program doesn't serve people over 80%. If they're making between 30 and 80, then they can receive 1 month payment and then go back into the system and have another shot at being selected. But the program is really intended to serve those at those deepest levels of affordability need.
And have they done any studies of the first part of the distribution of the funds so that we know how many people actually received the money and how many did not and how many ended up in the street as a result of all that? Do we don't have any information about that?
We did. We received 10,000 applicants, of which we were able to serve, we thought we were going to be serving about 1,000. And at the end of the day, we were able to, because of Lisa's administration of this and really making sure we understood everyone's income and deducted 30%, which was a challenge, but we were ultimately able to serve almost 1,700 people. So nearly two-thirds more than two-thirds more. So that was exciting. We overwhelmingly serve people, like three quarters of the money went to folks earning 30% and below. And Lisa has more demographic information about exactly who and what, but we were very encouraged, and the city was really encouraged, the right zip codes where we have seen, you know, consistent, documented, hardest hit need got served. So that was good.
Okay. But this is just 3 months. So now that money has been used up, all these people are back to ground zero, correct?
Well, these dollars have to be used up by December, and we think they'll probably be extended a little bit under if there's a new administration, the program may be completely redone. But our belief is that whoever's in power in Washington, that there'll be some extension beyond December 31st. But these dollars, the CARES Act dollars, coronavirus relief and emergency help dollars, have to be expended by December 31st. So we're on target right now to do just that.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
And I'll forward demographic and other information about round one, because I think it's interesting. If you have questions, we can talk about it further.
Of course I have questions. But we can talk about it further at maybe the next meeting.
Sure, yeah. I'm glad to. So, Mr. Chairman, we can, I think, pull off and go to executive session if that's appropriate.
Where is Mr. Chairman?
I'm here. I'm trying to multitask because I'm actually supposed to be in another meeting right now, and then I got another one before. So I'm going to go into executive session. If we're still there at 3 to 5, I better go. I just can't stay on. I'm actually trying to do two calls at the same time, and it's kind of a bit of a deal. But it's, you know, this is volunteer. I'm giving it my all, but also I got some pay going on simultaneously. So, but this time the board will recess into executive session pursuant to Section 551.071 of the Texas Government Code to consult with legal counsel regarding pending or contemplated litigation or settlement, 551.072, discussion about the purchase, exchange, lease, value, or real estate, 551.071 of the Texas Government Code to discuss the appointment, employment, evaluation, reassignment, duties, discipline, or dismissal of a public officer or employee, or to hear a complaint, charge, assistant officer. And in 551.087 of the Texas Government Code to discuss certain economic development negotiations. So at this point, we will drop off. We have been sent a second code to plug into. Is that correct, Nydia? And then we will plug into that other code, and then we will go into executive session. I'll open it up. We'll begin discussion. Chuck, you will probably have to take over if we're going to 3:45. So with that, I'll see you all shortly.